Tomorrow is Mother's Day, a day set aside to honor those who have been mothers. It was proclaimed in 1914 by President Woodrow Wilson. And today, 46 different countries commemorate Mother's Day. Most of the English-speaking nations have Mother's Day on the second Sunday in May, and various other nations celebrate at different other times during the year. So it is a highly popular day in this country, certainly. People spend certain amounts of money on Mother's Day, and perhaps you'd be interested to know what is spent where. Greeting cards. $792 million are spent by Americans on greeting cards for Mother's Day. If you're a florist, you will agree it's a good week to be a florist. $2.4 billion spent on bouquets of flowers for people's mothers. How about taking mom out to brunch? There are a lot of people that do that. $4.1 billion is spent on eating out. As far as gifts go, massage, gift cards, spa, memberships, and such, $1.6 billion is spent. My question is it enough? Maybe if there's a problem with a Mother's Day, it is, in spite of the figures I've just read, that Mother's Day is perhaps underrated. Why is it so significant? Who really authorized the concept of honoring one's mother? Where does the honor for mothers ultimately come from? And is this a subject that is narrow? Does this only apply to people that have living mothers today? No, not at all. It's a subject that really involves all of us. And I'd like to take the time to talk about that. I'd like to discuss Mother's Day and why we honor it. Why do we honor it? Turn to Deuteronomy 5 as we begin. To me, this is a fascinating subject. The more you study into it, the more you see the genius of God at work, how he instilled the certain instincts and abilities of intuition in mothers, in women. And in some cases, that he didn't give to man. I think of Mr. Armstrong's life and many of his accomplishments. He was maybe at his very, very best when, with God's help, hopefully, but with his wife at his side. When his wife Loma died, he lost his ability to understand. He never had the insight that she had. He said to different people that he was close to, "I just don't have the judgment that my wife had." And in Deuteronomy 5, we can see in the Ten Commandments, it says very early on in the list, in verse 14 says, notice this, first of all, the seventh day rest of the Lord is mentioned. And right after that, it says, verse 15, remember that you were a servant in the land of Egypt. I'm sorry. Verse 16, honor your father and your mother as the Lord your God has commanded you, that your days might be prolonged and that it might go well with you and in the land that the Lord your God gives you. Honor your mother. That's what it says to all of us. That's repeated in Exodus 20. It's repeated in Matthew 19, verse 19. There's another statement. I'll read that over in Romans chapter 13, verse 7. Romans 13, verse 7. Here we can see where it talks about showing honor and respect across the board in the society that we live in. Chapter 13, verse 7, render to, therefore, all their dues. Tribute to whom tribute is due. Custom to whom custom. Showing honor and respect to people of different customs or cultures. We pay our taxes. We show respect even to law authorities. Custom to whom custom. Fear to whom fear. Honor to whom honor. And there's no greater honor than we can bestow upon our parents than to honor them. That's what God would want. And in life, we learn to honor, and as we begin, we don't always do it perfectly. Oftentimes, children will try to show an expression of appreciation to mother if they've been encouraged. One little guy, Robert, said, he was about six, he wrote a card and says, "Dear Mom, I got you a turtle for Mother's Day. I hope you like the turtle better than that snake I got you last year." Little Diane wrote, "Mom, I hope you like the flowers I got for you on Mother's Day. I picked them myself when Mr. Smith wasn't looking." Angie, 8 years of age, wrote, quote, "Dear Mother, I'm going to make a dinner for you on Mother's Day. It's going to be a surprise. P.S. I hope you like pizza and popcorn." Well, these are darling little efforts, aren't they? And they can lead to big things. And it helps steer a child into the way that he should go, he or she, that that child will want to show respect, want to show honor to one's mother. These revelations encourage the imperfect effort of those who are learning how to honor. And that process never stops. There might be a few challenges along the way. Nobody said that motherhood was easy. Fatherhood is not easy if it's done well. But young mothers know that their kitchen utensils are probably out in the sandbox. That real mothers probably have often sticky floors and filthy ovens and happy kids. Real mothers know that dried Play-Doh doesn't come out of shag carpets. Real mothers do not want to know what the vacuum cleaner just picked up. And when mothers get exasperated and they say, "Why me?" they get the little answer from a little voice that says, "Because I love you the best." Real mothers have an investment in the future because their children are the future. And a number of us have had mothers who have died. And maybe some mothers have lost children to death, premature. A lot of these things have happened. And it might seem from a distance, well, this is a subject only to mothers who are actively taking care of children now. But it's way beyond that. It's way beyond that. There's always time to honor our mothers and to honor women. And it is something that can be expanded, where if we don't have a mother, we can adopt a mother or a grandmother, where we can enhance the lives of others. If we don't have children, we can help those that do. Make a difference. Make a contribution. Be part of a larger family. The concept of motherhood and nurturing is so very incredible, and it's profound, and it runs deeply. And the human race cannot survive without that nurture. There are some people who will say, "Yes, I know a mother that likes to smother." But God even ingrained some of that to make sure that we don't come up short and allow the human race to just disintegrate because of lack of nurture, because of lack of care. And it is very, very deep and deeply impressed. It's amazing that people, when they're born, well, babies, when they're born, oftentimes the first thing they see is the face of their mother. Is it more than coincidence that in combat situations where people are fatally wounded and they're ready to die, that so often their minds flash back to their mothers? And many will call out. I've read stories. I remember the RAF, the Royal English Air Force, that was defending the country against the German Luftwaffe in World War II. And one person was severely wounded and flying his plane, and he said to his comrade, he says, I'll be okay. Tell mother." Mothers are not that far away from us in times of need. And people sometimes will ignore it, ignore motherhood, and then feel maybe driven by guilt or whatever to get a card on Mother's Day or to make some gesture, or "I really need to call my mother," and the phone lines get jammed. And then the rest of the year, the honor can be dissipated. And that's not what God would want. He wants us to honor those that are in the positions of receiving honor and the sacrifices that the woman make are remembered on Mother's Day, and we can never take that for granted. We just never can. An interesting statement was made by the Apostle Paul when he exhorted different ministers to show concern to their people and their congregations in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, and let's go to verse 3 and read the words of the Apostle Paul, who was trying to encourage the people that he was supervising to have deep and genuine nurturing care for the brethren. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 3, he's writing and saying, "For our exhortation was not of deceit, nor of uncleanness, nor in guile." He says, we're trying to help and do the right things for the right reasons. "But as we were allowed of God to be put in trust with the gospel, even so we speak, not as pleasing men, but God, which tries our heart." We're just trying to do the right thing, regardless of whether it's popular or not. For verse 5, "For neither at any time did we use flattering words, as you know, not a cloak of covetousness." God is a witness to that. He was not trying to pull anything over on anybody. Verse 6, "Nor of men sought we glory," you know, in the role of being in the ministry. And then verse 7, "But instead, we were gentle among you, even as a nurse cherishes her children. So, being affectionately desirous of you, we were willing to have imparted unto you not the gospel of God only, but also our own souls," our own lives, "because you were dear unto us." In other words, he's saying that his associates needed to take care of the brethren as a mother takes care of a precious infant. To have that kind of tender concern, consciousness, love, deep affection. And that's the way we are to be with each other. And that was what Paul said he wanted to do. Not for show, not to try to pretend to be anything, but that this is what he was. And he lived it, breathed it, expressed it. Mothers do that by instinct, naturally. And they'll all say that even when they bring life into the world, having life living inside of them for 9 months is a life-changing experience. Life-changing. I won't refer turn to Exodus 21, verse 25. I'll just refer to it. But God was so determined that motherhood would be exalted that if anybody showed great respect, disrespect to mothers or fathers and were to smite them, what a bizarre concept, that person would be put to death. God would not equivocate over something like that. What I'd like to do is now turn to Leviticus 19 and just elevate the concept of motherhood in Leviticus 19, and maybe in a way that we haven't considered. Leviticus 19. The ability to nurture is powerful. And women gravitate to that naturally. Sometimes, as I mentioned, some can smother. There was a case one time where a mother was invited by her husband to go to a business banquet. And the CEO would be there and vice presidents would be there. And she ended up sitting next to the table. Her seat was right next to the at the head table next to the founder of the entire company. And she didn't care about that. He had some crumbs on his under his lip, and she just couldn't help herself. Took her napkin, starts dabbing him a little bit and so forth. Nobody else would even dare do that. Half the people were afraid to talk to him. But, once you're a mother, you're always a mother. So it just was inherent in her. In Leviticus, that makes me think of another person who had the nurture instinct. It was one of the instructors from Ambassador. He came to Tampa one time, and I gave a sermonette, and he walked right up to me. He says, "About your message, I want to evaluate that." And he says, "It was good. It was this, but you could have done that," and so forth. And then he stopped. He realized he'd never been to this congregation ever. And he says, "Oh, maybe I shouldn't have done all this." He says, "You can't help it. It's in my blood. I can't, it's my nature to evaluate." Well, that was fine. Mothers naturally are in tune with their children. If I carried life inside of me for a year or 9 months or whatever, maybe I would have a different perspective. But it's astounding that God created that. Now, Leviticus 19 and verse 3 says, "You shall fear every man his mother and his father, and keep my Sabbath. I am the Lord your God." Most people will say that are Sabbatarian, "Oh, Sabbath, that's very important. What's more important than keeping God's holy Sabbath?" Well, showing respect to one's mother is right, is equal to that. We're to do both. There's, in the same breath, God is inspiring Moses to write here, "You know, you shall fear every man his mother, or at least honor, show profound respect, and his father, and keep my Sabbaths," all in the same breath. They're of equal status. They're all very important. I'll read this from the New Living Translation. "Each of you should show great respect for your father and your mother, and you must always observe the Sabbath days of rest." In another place, in Proverbs chapter 6, Proverbs chapter 6, in verse 20. There are a number of Proverbs that speak to this concept of fatherhood and motherhood. In chapter 6 and verse 20. Says, "My son, keep your father's commandments and forsake not the law of your mother." What's the law of one's mother? It's instructions. And sometimes there's resistance to that. But it's something to be noted, something to be appreciated. There have been any number of teenagers over the millennia on this earth that have said at different times, "Mom, you just don't love me. Or you're just not allowing me to have the freedom that my friends have. I want to run with this crowd. Or I want to do this or that. You don't love me." How many times have mothers' kids laid that on them? "You're restrictive." There comes a time when a mom can say, when the child now is a full-fledged adult and sees the rest of life, then mom can say, "I loved you enough. Don't tell me I didn't care. I loved you enough to harass you about where you were going and what time you would get home. I loved you enough to let you discover that your friend was a creep. I loved you enough to stand over you for 2 hours while you cleaned your bedroom, a job that would have only taken me 15 minutes to do. I loved you enough to ignore what all the other mothers allegedly said or did. I loved you enough to let you stumble, fall, hurt, and fail on occasion. I loved you enough to accept you for what you are and not always what I wanted you to be. And most of all, I loved you enough to say no when sometimes you hated me for it." And that's just the nature of it sometimes. Sometimes a mother can see things that a son or daughter doesn't grasp, or at least not right away. And another interesting statement in Proverbs 23 and verse 22. Here it says, "Hearken unto your father that begat you, despise not your mother when she is old." And where there have been some very deep, profound relationships between mother and child, that has blossomed and becomes ever deeper in adulthood. And it's a beautiful thing to see people, even in advanced years, highly honored for their contributions to their families and to society. Thomas Edison made the statement, "My mother was the making of me." Because Thomas Edison was in trouble all the time at school for his experiments, as teacher finally had a meeting and said, "You're going to have to homeschool this kid because he is just dumb. Dumb, dumb, dumb. He doesn't know what he's doing. He's a head case." And she, as he wrote it, "My mother was the making of me. She was so true and so sure of me. I felt I had someone to live for. someone I must not disappoint. The memory of my mother will always be a blessing to me. That's because the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world. The hand that rocks the cradle rules the world. Satan hates motherhood. He would like to do anything to stop it. He's attacked fatherhood. But motherhood is the last line of defense. In some of the inner cities and in ghettos, the only person left to respect is the matriarch, the grandmother, in a number of communities. If Satan can inspire mothers to abdicate their responsibilities, to buy into the lie that abortion is good for society, then he has total control of the human race. Can you manipulate it like silly putty? That would be an ultimate tragedy. There are some phenomenal examples of people that had great mothers that honored them continuously, and Edison being one of a number of them, a number of famous people. In fact, the more famous people are, the more likely they have a mother that believed in them, supported them, no matter what. And it's wonderful to learn from those examples, I think. A fascinating book by Harold Gulam is entitled Faith of Our Fathers. Faith of Our Mothers. And it's a fascinating story of first ladies and wives of U.S. presidents, so many that dealt with adversity, some that went into bankruptcy and into poverty, but they had to inspire their youth, their children, and they were unflagging, unwavering. We're behind them. I'm behind you. I believe in you. You can do something. And Thomas Edison's mother was that way. She understood that he was different, that he had unusual abilities, and she didn't doubt him. She supported him. Again, the hand that rules rocks the cradle can rule the world. I talk about mothers of different presidents. There were some that lost children when they were devastated, some that went into deep depression. Jackie Kennedy, for one, lost a baby when she was in the White House. There was a case of Hannah Milhouse Nixon. She lost two sons to tuberculosis, then finally had Richard Nixon and four other children. And she came, a very deeply religious person, trusted that God would get her through some of these trials. And at the time, these people seemed ordinary on the outside, but they had a deep abiding faith in their children and a confidence that they could help inspire, encourage these people. There was Dorothy Walker Bush, the mother of George H.W. Bush. When George was in World War II, he was shot down and presumed to be dead, missing in action. Finally discovered by a submarine and brought back to safety, but they learned that when he was shot down, his two associates died. He said that he knew that his mother was praying for him because she always prayed. She was very determined, dedicated like that. And he just had this feeling that she was on his side, and that somewhere, somehow, either she knew or she was going to persist in praying for his welfare. Now, later on, he mentioned that his mom was very, very competitive. She was a world-class tennis player. But she was fair. She believed in fairness and she believed in good sportsmanship. When her little son, who became president, says, "Mom, guess what today? I was 8 years old. I scored 3 goals in soccer." She goes, "Uh-huh. Tell me, George, how did the team do?" It's a team sport. So she was always trying to round him out and constantly giving advice. And then he says, "George, I know you're running for president, but don't talk about yourself too much. People won't go for that." But Mom, I'm running for president. I have to tell something about myself. Well, a little bit, that's okay. But don't go overboard on this. But these people that had sons were part of a strong nurture. Strong nurture. And yet, even according to her grandson, Jeb Bush, when he was governor, he said, "My dad's mom was the most loving person I ever met. So kind, so gentle, and yet so competitive." But Dorothy Bush, at one point, lost her 8-year-old daughter, Robin, to leukemia. And she was devastated for a while. Went into deep depression. And yet, in spite of that, believed in what she was doing, believed that she had a right to be on this earth and that she was going to take care of those that were entrusted to her care, and wasn't thinking, "I'm going to have my son's going to be the president of the United States." That wasn't on the radar. It was just, "I believe in my son. I'm going to give my son whatever opportunities I can and be there for them." And as it turned out, in her life, looking back, she married a U.S. senator, and she did have a son that became president and a grandson. That's more than coincidence. When you study the families that were in the White House, there was this drive. "I believe in what we're doing. I'm there. I'm supporting the home fires here at the White House, and I'm shielding my family as much as I can from the criticism that comes from the outside, but we're going to make it." Nell Reagan was a very religious woman, and she risked her life in going to tuberculosis centers to help the needy, and visited people in prisons and any number of other church activities. She was extremely religious and felt that her calling was to serve humanity. And additionally, she was an actress, and she told her little son, Ronnie, "You ought to be in one of these church plays. Now, I think you can do it." And so he did it, and she encouraged him. "Well, you're good at being out in front of people. I believe you could do more than that. I think that you could be a representative or a speaker, whatever." And he followed her footsteps and got into theater. And that led him to a career in radio and broadcasting, and he was very at ease. And then he became part of the Actors Guild in Hollywood. And from there, he switched to politics. And he always enjoyed connecting with crowds of people. But that was not going to ever happen unless he had encouragement as a child. Sarah Delano Roosevelt was always bending Franklin's ear. Elizabeth Jackson, mother of Andrew Jackson, was a fireball. She was a defender fierce of her family. And during the Revolutionary War, the British captured her two sons, Andrew and another one. They were teenagers, but they were facing life. They were going to face the firing squad. And Elizabeth Jackson was not about to let that happen. So she marched over to the Continental Army and she says, "We need to get my sons released." "Get away from us, lady. What do you know about war?" And she said, "Well, I'm going to do it." And she talked them into giving up 14 British POWs. And I don't know if they were handcuffed or if she had a rifle and just marched with them, but they went right on over to the British camp, and she could have been captured herself and thrown in the brig. But she said, "I'm Jackson, Andrew's mother, and I demand that you release him and my other son. And here's the deal. 14 of your guys for my two sons." And they were, what were they going to do? Okay, yeah, they were intimidated. They let her have them. And that's the kind of background that she had. As he said later, there was never a woman like her. She was gentle as a dove and brave as a lioness. The memory of my mother and her teachings were, after all, the only capital I had to start life with. And on that capital, I have made my way. Dwight Eisenhower's parents went through adversity. In 1888, the general store that they ran went bankrupt. Eisenhower worked feverishly to salvage what they had, and she inspired her son with the same intensity level. There was a woman by the name of Dorothy King, lived in Omaha. She married an abusive husband, constantly harassed by him. Didn't know what to do. There are programs for people that wrestle with these things today, but that didn't exist back at that time. And she kept hoping it would get better, and it only got worse. It got to be pretty dicey one night when she held her little infant, and he came storming drunk, and he threatened her and pulled a knife out. "I can't live here anymore," she thought. "Where am I going to go? Where am I going to go?" But she was so intimidated and so scared that she was so determined to persevere and to be behind her child that she decided to run away and to be a woman alone on the streets and all. Very, very dangerous if you go, well, at any time. But back then, she decided to make it to the bus station and got a ticket to Grand Rapids, Michigan. And here she was feeling quite abandoned, but she wasn't going to give up. It was her nurture. She had a life to take care of. She never thought when she ran out that night in Omaha with one suitcase in her hand that she had in her other arm the future 38th President of the United States. When she got to Grand Rapids, she did meet somebody who was a wonderful man. Gerald Ford was his name. And young Gerald, her son, as a teenager, said, "I want to change my name. I love my stepdad so much. I think so much of him. I want to change my name to Gerald R. Ford Jr., which he did. And when the Watergate crisis happened, the resignation of Spiro Agnew as vice president, 1973 and then 74, there was a crisis of leadership, yes. And there was a crisis in the fact that, wow, there seems like people that we would nominate to take Nixon's place would be accused of corruption or shady dealings and so forth. Who do we have that everybody knows is Mr. Integrity, that is totally honest? And only one name would keep surfacing: Gerald Ford. People marveled that while other politicians had sizable amounts of money that he had built up, he was worth very little by comparison. He wasn't in there to make a lot of money. He was trying to be careful and be honest to the nth degree. And it was because of the way his mother raised him and the standards and the values that she had that she believed in honesty. Not that she was only one, many did, but still, it was very, very important. Any number of people, mothers, have made their mark on history just because they were trying to work with their children and make something of them. Is that to suggest that if we spank up a child in the way he should go, he's going to be the President of the United States? No, but something bigger. We talk about being kings and priests in the world tomorrow, Revelation 5, verse 10. In Isaiah and Psalm 45, it talks about princes and princesses that we could raise. So if we forget that, we're thinking too small. We have grandchildren that we can invest time in and believe in, or other people's children, and that can be easily done. I think any parent would welcome if they had an adoptive quote-unquote uncle or aunt or somebody that would be willing to help make a difference in somebody else's life, give them some encouragement. We have a society that says, "No, you can't, you're no good, nothing's going to work, be negative," and so forth. There is a resounding, continual barrage of that. This is the society that Satan heavily influences. Not that all life is that way, but oftentimes. It's nice when there's a team of people behind a child that says, "Yes, you can. I believe in you. You can do it. You can do it. You can do it." And this is what these wives of these presidents, they were under heavy pressure. their husbands were always vilified in the press, in many cases unfairly. Abraham Lincoln was called by his peers the gorilla in the White House. And negative press and false news and so forth is nothing new. As in fact, some of that was brought out by the in the most recent issue of the Beyond Today. And so there's a lot of resistance out there. At the summer camp, we have what we call the zone, where people are unconditionally accepted and encouraged. If somebody belittles another person, they're out. That's not where that's going to be tolerated. The climate is of one that encourages care, unity, and achievement. And instead of telling the one, you know, new camper who's 12 years old maybe, "Wow, that was a terrible serve in that volleyball game. You need to hit it over the net." It's better to say, "No, pretty good effort. Just get a little higher and you'll have it. You didn't get the high ropes this year? Probably will next year." And give different opportunities for achievement. We do that in sports and in Christian living. It's just across the board all day long. But there's emphasis, you can do it. What if you tell your son or your daughter, your grandson or your nephew or whoever, a little bit of that nurturing instinct, you can do it well. I believe in you. The human mind has the ability to do phenomenal things. There is some genius in all of us. But as I forget the philosopher said, one of the great tragedies of life is that people go to their graves with their music still inside of them. They weren't inspired. They didn't have somebody or a teacher at the right time or a mother or whatever to be able to intervene. But for all the ups and downs of life, it is huge when there are forces of nurture that are behind it. And that's what Mother's Day can commemorate. The can-do attitude manifested at a camp is something that can happen in a family or a school or anywhere. Proverbs 23, verse 7 says, "For as a person thinks in his heart," or her heart, "so is she," or he. "As a person thinks in his heart, so is he." And we are what we think to many in many cases. A lot of times, society has told us we were no good, didn't amount to anything, whatever was unfair. Maybe family members said that, didn't perhaps mean it that way. Maybe some did. But the reality is that we all have phenomenal potential. And we can make a difference when we help nurture others around us. And the sky's the limit. God created human beings with phenomenal potential. We only utilize between 3 and 5% of our brains. There's so much more that we could are capable of. And a lot of it is driven by how well we are cared for. I've used the example in the past, 1970s, in San Francisco in the school system, an experiment was run. And the people that behind it took three teachers out of the hundreds in the San Francisco Bay Area. They chose by random three teachers, and they brought them in and they lied to them. They said, "We have a special project. We're going to have you teach the best, the cream of the crop, the best students that we have in the entire area. They're going to be brought into this particular school where you three are going to be. And they are the best of the best. And the reason we chose you is we've been watching you for a long time, and we know that you're the three best teachers in the San Francisco Bay Area." Wow. They were excited. And they said, "We know that there's going to be high achievement, and we just want to measure how high it will go." Well, they were inspired. The year got started, and they just poured their hearts into these students. And these students that were chosen were not the cream of the crop. They were chosen by computer at random. So they were teaching these students as if they had genius IQs, and they didn't. And at the end of the year, they said, well, what do you think? They said, wow, this is the best class I ever had. Yeah, it was really amazing, wasn't it? Absolutely. Why, these kids, they learn so fast. And what was happening was that the teachers were treating them the way they would become. They were treating them as if they were geniuses, not a bunch of knuckleheads. And so the students responded, and they learned, and they reached, and they were challenged, and they blew the ceiling off of the testing. And one girl climbed 50 points in her IQ in 1 year. There were incredible changes. So at the end of the year, then they said, we have a confession to make to the three of you. Oh, you know, you did a job that exceeded our expectations. And we want to say congratulations. It shows you what can happen with human beings. But we got to tell you, those students were not the best or the brightest necessarily. They were chosen at random. And the teachers were in shock. Wow, that's amazing. They were just chosen at random, huh? That's right. So a few might have had high IQs. Some would have maybe below average, whatever. Wow, that's amazing. Oh, but we know why this happened. Well, you chose us, the three best teachers in the San Francisco Bay. No, that's not exactly the case. You were chosen by the computer. It's like, well, what have we done? We've proved that the human spirit is so resilient that if it's fueled by nurture, that the sky's the limit. You can create a super race of people, in a sense, high achievers. And where there are families like that, people thrive. They seem to excel. Now, they can be mentored, and they can be steered more specifically. But like what the woman said that lived next to the Kennedy compound in Hyannis, Massachusetts, growing up. The Kennedys were 9 kids. John Kennedy was one, you know. People remember him, remember Robert, who was Attorney General. The family thought that Joseph Kennedy would become the president one day, but he was killed in World War II. But one girl that lived growing up next to them said, when I looked at that family and saw that intensity that those parents had for those kids, she said, we knew that one of them would be president one day. Well, it would be John or Robert or Ted or something. Well, there are other causes involved. But the reason I note that is that the nurture was very, very powerful. As Joseph Kennedy said, and he was wealthy and he didn't have to work anymore, so he spent 100% of his time with his children, all 9. He says, my family is my business, and my business is my family. So he was very inspired. With that in mind, let's take a look at 2 Timothy. 2 Timothy chapter 1. I'll get there. 2 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 3. Paul says, I thank God whom I serve for my forefathers with a pure conscience, that without ceasing I have remembered you. And he's writing to Timothy, in my prayers night and day, greatly desiring to see you soon, being mindful of your tears, that I could be filled with joy. When I call into remembrance the unfeigned love that is in you. And he raved about Timothy just last Sabbath. Victor Cubic gave a sermon there at the General Conference talking about he would, in a heartbeat, hire a Timothy at any time that because of the concern that Timothy had for the people. So he says here, I call remembering the unfeigned love that was in you, which first dwelt in your grandmother, Lois, and then in your mother, Eunice. I am also persuaded that it is in you also. He had the equivalent of 2 mothers that were nurturing, that were behind him, that encouraged him in Scripture, encouraged him to be a Christian. And it may not have been as easy or as natural as you might think, because where was Dad in this? He had a he was not part of the church. Maybe he was happily married to them, to his wife. We don't know the detail, but all the spiritual nurture could have been just from his mother. So there would be a difference of religious philosophy within the family, but it didn't matter. If both parents can make an impact, but one parent can make a strong impact. And here is an example of somebody that for sure had his mother. And you can't, it is such a blessing to have at least one parent. I recall in one of the, there was a movie that was put out by a Christian group out of Georgia, and they show the scene where the police are tracking down juveniles that are selling drugs. And this one person got caught up in it with him. It just didn't have wanted, I guess, desperately to belong to a group, and had no family. And to do that, that meant he had to run with the crowd, and that he was risking his life and risking being caught by the law and risking going to jail for many years. And so here the scene shows this big shootout where the police are surrounding this young man who is about 20 who had the drugs in the back of the vehicle, and instead of surrendering, he whips out his gun, starts firing away at the police. And ultimately, enough police get there and they subdue the villains. And here's this 16-year-old guy in the back, and the officer points a gun just at him just to make sure that he's, you know, self-defense. And then he realizes he's unarmed, so he puts his gun away. And he says, "Why are you? I know you. You dated my daughter. Why are you mixed up with these people?" And he had tears streaming down his cheeks. And instead of saying, "Well, I needed the money, or I wanted the fame, or I wanted to some friends," he just gets right to the bottom line. Tears streaming down. He's not trying to hide anything. He says, "I don't have nobody. I don't have nobody. There's nobody for me. There's no nurture. There's no, I believe you can do it. You can do it." And so he drifted off with these wrong people. And in the story, he himself was redeemed. It's good to have a cheerleader or somebody that's genuinely sincere but is supportive. Now, sometimes people can be blind with their support. There was one proud mother, World War I, Americans came home marching down Broadway, and there everybody's cheering ticker tape parade, and she says, "Oh my Danny, I'm so proud of him." Everybody was out of step except him, you know, marching along. So sometimes with almost a blindness. But so what's so bad about being supportive and encouraging? There was one critical time in ancient Israel's history where somebody needed to do that. You talk about standing in the gap. Over in 2 Chronicles 33. 2 Chronicles chapter 33. The story of a young boy who was 8 years old, and now he was king over Judah. Chapter 33, verse 20. Highly improbable situation. So it says, Manasseh, a previous king, died, and they buried him in his own house, and Amon, his son, reigned in his stead. Amon was 2 and 20 years old. When he began to reign, he reigned 2 years in Jerusalem, and he did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord, just like Manasseh, his father. He sacrificed to the carved images which Manasseh, his father, had made and served them. He humbled not himself before the Lord, as Manasseh did eventually, but Amon trespassed more and more. And he was such a bad leader, his servants conspired against him and slew him in his own house. But the people of the land slew all of them that had conspired against King Amon. And so there was a lot of support for what Amon was pushing with these false idols. And Josiah, son of Amon, was king in his stead. We go to the next chapter, 34, verse 1. Josiah was just 8 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned in Jerusalem 31 years. He did that which was right in the sight of the Lord. Why would he know that if his father was wicked? He walked in all the ways of David, his father, declined neither to the right hand or the left. And in the eighth year of his reign, while he was yet young, he began to seek after the God of David, his father. And in the 12th year, he began to purge Judah and Jerusalem of the high places and the groves and the carved images. Perhaps some people guess as young as 16, declaring war on idolatry. But the thing that was so critical was that he had a mother that was so inspiring. I guess it's in the account over in Kings, but oftentimes when there would be a child that was ruling, that it would say, and his mother was, it would be somebody that was right there to nurture him. He didn't dream of knowing what to do that was right. That had to come from nurture, and it had to come from mother. And mother had to be as tough as nails, like a Pat Nixon or a Sarah Delano Roosevelt or Elizabeth Jackson. Had to be tough as nails because her husband was just the opposite. Her husband was against God and the things of God. So she had to stand for what was right and to steer her son that way. Mom was going to raise the child, Josiah, right and risk everything in doing that. That's quite an accomplishment. It's gutsy. If you ask, well, what are mothers anyway? Mothers are teachers, they're disciplinarians, they're cleaning ladies. Some mothers are gardeners, mowers of lawns. Mothers are nurses, doctors, psychologists, counselors, chauffeurs, and coaches. There was a lawyer that met a housewife at a function. She asked what the woman did. The woman answered, well, currently I am socializing two homo sapiens in the dominant values of the Judeo-Christian tradition in order that they might be instruments of the transformation of the social order into the teleologically prescribed utopia inherent in the eschaton. And then she said, well, and what do you do? He says, oh, I'm just an attorney. Oh, wow. So, a mother can make a huge difference. People have heard of John Wesley, Charles Wesley, that were theologians that made their mark a century or so ago. And they were driven by the support of their mother. And their mother was Susanna Wesley, had 17 children. She prayed 1 hour for all 17, every day. That's every day, aside from who she would pray for else, or what else she would ask God to work out. Just on her 17 sons, she devoted 1 hour every day. And two of them became very famous. She loved them all the best. One person said to one grandmother, you've got all these kids, grandkids and all, who do you love the most? She's thought about it. She says, at the time, the one that needs me the most. George Washington said, my mother was the most beautiful woman I ever saw. All I am, I owe to my mother. I attribute all my success in life to the moral, intellectual, and physical education I received from her. Now, she didn't agree with him going to war, the Revolutionary War, but as far as general principle, she was behind him, nurtured him, supported him. Abraham Lincoln said, all that I am or ever hope to be, I owe to my angel mother. That's an extraordinary story. To me, even more fascinating is Mary, the mother of Christ. When God had arranged for Christ to be born, he knew he couldn't just get any woman to be the mother. It had to be somebody that was flexible, that was a woman of faith, which she was. Also, one that had a stomach of iron, to be able to endure insults and criticisms that would be thrown, perhaps inspired at times like fiery darts from Satan himself. I'm sure that as he grew up, knowing how life is even for all of us and the culture that we live in, that kids Christ's age would come to him and say, "What's wrong with you? Don't you ever use swear words? You ought to be one of the guys, not Mr. Goody Two Shoes. Haven't you ever experimented with wine? Well, I guess you don't belong. Well, yeah, you're illegitimate. That's right. You're a loser." And on with insults after insults. Mom had to have a thick skin. Mary Lincoln Todd had a thick skin. So did Warren High Harding's wife. So did, Jacqueline Kennedy. Not easy living in the fishbowl. Not easy at all. Irma Bombeck talks about the act of God in creating mothers. And her rendition was, she said that on the day that God created mothers, he had already worked long overtime. And an angel said, "Are you sure spending a lot of time on this creation?" And God said to her, this didn't really happen, but this was Irma Bombeck's rendition, that the Lord had responded, haven't you ever read the specs on this model? She's supposed to be completely washable, but not plastic. She has to have 180 moving parts, all of them replaceable. She is to have a kiss that will heal everything from a broken leg to a broken heart. She is to have a lap that will disappear whenever she stands up. She has to be able to function on black coffee and leftovers, and is supposed to have 6 pairs of hands. But that's impossible. How about 3 pairs of eyes to know what's going on everywhere with the children and anything else simultaneously? And the angel said, "Well, that's too much. You can't put that much in one model. Why don't you just rest and resume your creation the next day?" And he said, "No, I can't do that. I'm close to creating someone very much like myself. I've already come up with a model that can heal herself when she is sick, who can feed a family of 6 with 1 pound of hamburger, and who can persuade a 9-year-old to take a shower." Then the angel looked at the model of motherhood a little more closely and said, "Oh, but she's too soft." "Oh, but she's tough," said the Lord. "You'd be surprised how much this mother can do." "Can she think?" asked the angel. "Not only can she think," said the Lord, "she can reason and compromise and persuade." And then the angel reached over and touched her cheek and said, "Well, this model has a leak. I told you couldn't put that much in one model." The response was, "That's not a leak, that's a tear." It's just astonishing what women can nurture. Douglas MacArthur said, "My sainted mother taught me devotion to God and the love of country, which has ever sustained me. To her I yield anew a son's reverent thanks." So many people attribute their success in life to their nurture that they received. We can do that. In the course of motherhood, one person said, their children are like kites. You spend a lifetime trying to get them off the ground. You run with them until you're both breathless. They crash and you add a longer tail, like you're the kite. You patch and comfort and adjust and teach and assure that someday they will fly. Finally, they are airborne, but they need more strings, so you keep letting it out. You keep letting it out. And with each twist of the ball of twine, the kite becomes more distant. You know it won't be long before that beautiful creature will snap the lifeline that bind you together and soar free and alone. Only then will you know that you've done your job. And so the sequence is, when a child's born, he says, "Mama, Mama." And later on, he says, "Mom." And then finally, as he becomes full-fledged adult, "Mother." Mr. Holliday talks of a story where there was a wife who told her husband, I think it's time for you to go on a date with another woman." And he was a little surprised. And she said, "I think you ought to need to have a date with my mom, something that has never happened before." take her out to dinner and take her out to movie. And so he thought about it. He says, well, if you want, okay. Showing deference and honor to his mother-in-law. And so he told the mother-in-law about that, and she was so surprised. And she said, well, I'll do that. Sure, we can do that. And so they went out to a restaurant, and they just talked and talked and talked. They never got around to the movie. It was too late to go, but they had a great time. And then he got a note in the mail a couple days later. It was tickets for two at that restaurant for her son-in-law and then her daughter, husband and wife. So next week they could go out and have an evening meal. But what he didn't realize was that even though she was smiling ear to ear and was telling everybody about the fantastic time she had, she died a few days later. And he was so glad that he actually was talked into doing something for her like that. And the point being, you never know how much time you have. And so a day like tomorrow is certainly a day of opportunity, but it can't just be the only day in the year. Nurture an appreciation for that and honor and respect for those that give and give and give and give is something that we should understand as a church and be very much supportive of. Mother's Day is, can be superficially viewed, or it can be something that is treasured because of the depth and the magnitude that it has. And I just think that when you look at what is accomplished, it's just a marvelous part of God's creation that He can still nurture in people. Now, men can have that too. There are coaches, there are teachers and leaders that are men. But there's something special about women and what they bring to a family and to a society. We desperately need our women, and we desperately need to honor them.